late 70s, early 80s. I took the spectrum that I didn't hear and mapped it down into the region that I could hear. And boy, is that confusing. But we read about, let me let it drop. We read about some experiments that were done where they were basically taking a coil and wrapping it around the nerve ending, the cochlea, and using that to literally, I don't understand how magnetic induction across the nerve fiber is going to induce voltages in the actual ends of the dendrites of the nerves that are going up. But just for the heck of it, we took a really big amplifier and made a really big coil and tried to, you know, put that next to your head and hear stuff. And interestingly enough, I mean, there's a lot of heating going on. It seems to do something. You know, it was a very unscientific, wild man experiment, but it was something that I did. And actually, it did actually make me hear stuff that I didn't hear.
Yeah, I wonder what that sounded like. On top of that, if they were offering a cochlear implant to you, where you've got reasonably good hearing, except up to, let me pick a number, 1.5 kc and beyond, and the cochlear implant, if you went for that operation, I guess there's a certain probability you end up worse off than you are right now, and therefore you wouldn't be happy. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, that's the opinion that I've had ever since I started learning about stuff like that. You know, by the way, I don't know if you remember, years ago at Hamfest, and I'm talking many years ago, it was 60s, 70s, they used to have a Hewlett-Packard audio generator, and they would lock the dial so you couldn't see it. There would be a pair of headphones and a frequency counter. It would be a contest. Who could get as close as they possibly could to 1,000 hertz? And I would always win because my hearing cuts off at exactly 999.9 hertz.
Wow. Did you also find out who could hear the highest frequencies? Did you ever find a person that could hear 19 kilohertz, so to speak?
I know a few people that are in the music industry like that. And every time they get near a TV set with a flyback going, they start screaming.
In my youth, when I was doing television repair, when I was 17 years of age, I could walk into a house and tell you exactly how many television sets are working because I would hear the 15.75 kilohertz. I don't hear that anymore. I'm very happy about that. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Oh, no, there was one guy who's actually a rather famous mix engineer, and he claimed that he could hear almost 20 kilohertz. And we put him to the test, and son of a gun, he could hear 19.85 kilohertz.
Yeah, I wonder, is it just pure age that makes people lose the high frequencies, or is it exposure? I was running a lot of model airplane engines, which are very loud, inside of a closed basement of my house, checking out those engines before putting them on my airplane. So I exposed myself in my youth to a lot of very high noise. I think that aggravated my high frequency hearing. What do you think on that one, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
AC2GS. It's wear and tear. If you don't use it, you don't quite lose it. But they're the first ones to go. The high frequency ears are the closest to the outside world. They get the biggest jolt from sounds that you have in your environment, and so they're the first ones to go. I took a look at a couple of pictures of cochlear implants. For the most sake, it's powered externally. It's inductively powered the way that chargers now charge iPhones, and it amounts to a little wire that's threaded through the cochlear all the way to the very center of it, and it just excites the wire there and generates a amplified signal and is decoded to a degree by the nerves that run to your brain.
What do you mean by a wire? Is it making an electrical connection, or is it making sound within the cochlea?
They describe it as an electrode, so I assume that it's an actual electrode that is emitting some kind of electromagnetic magnetic energy into your cochlea.
I'm going to guess, Roy, that that is a bare piece of wire simply placed in the cochlea. The cochlea has a conductive fluid, a saline fluid in there. If you put a small amount of voltage on that wire, there will be conduction from that bare wire into the saline solution and into those nerve fibers. That's a guess. Over to you, Roy.
That's as good a guess as I would give as well. I don't think there's a lot of finesse to this design. It's kind of just works, so, you know, they'll probably play with the implant to tweak changing the equalization curves and what have you. But I think that ultimately we don't really have a good feel for neural interfaces, you know. You know, when the Borg assault us and we're all turned into the Borg, then we're going to be able to design all kinds of wonderful interfaces. But they're all kludges at this point of our evolution.
Roy, have you ever heard a report of a good response? Has anyone ever put a cochlear response and a cochlear device and the patient then could hear 100 hertz to 10 kilohertz, so to speak? Go ahead.
Well, again, since I'm not an ENT guy, I don't really read too much of that end of the literature. I think that anyone who kind of goes into a cochlear implant as that they were just going to get the ability to hear again like they once had, if they once had it, or anyone else has, I think they'll be incredibly disappointed. And incredibly, having a discussion about cochlear implants with people who are impaired hearing is almost like having religious arguments with people. They have very strong emotions about pro or anti cochlear implants.
Yeah, there are hearing impaired people who have been using sign language all their life, and external hearing devices are offered to them, and an awful lot of them say, this is the life I've always lived, I don't want to change it.
Well, I can make an argument with that, because I know a lot of folks that are totally deaf, and they actually welcome devices that allow them to actually feel sound, and they learn to differentiate from it, and they're very happy with it.
You know, as I always say, different strokes for different folks. Whatever you want, so be it. As long as it doesn't kind of injure me, you know, I'm a little libertarian, at least in that way of thinking. And I can understand and appreciate different people have different ways of looking upon the same thing, and nothing is an obviously one way or the other. You have to fit it for your way of looking upon the world. Everyone has their own worldview. And you're really not going to change people's worldview. I tried when I was much younger and folly of my youth.
No, I can understand that. Well, I do know this much in terms of how the ear works, how the length of the little hairs that stick up, how they resonate at different frequencies. The concept of a wire going through there is just a little befuddling to think about how you would do frequency differentiation. Whereas if you're creating an electrical charge, say, within the fluid that's in the cochlea, I can't quite understand why it wouldn't just light up every nerve.
AC2IS, comment.
Yes, Bill.
This conversation is reminding me of a story of people trying to teach American Sign Language to various groups of kids. There was one group of kids where they called in consultants because for some reason they were not able to teach American Sign Language to the kids. And when the consultant showed up just to check out the situation to find out what was going wrong, they discovered that a large group of kids that had been together for a long time, and they had developed their own sign language. So when people came in to teach them American Sign Language, the kids felt that this American Sign Language was not a good fit for them, that they we're happy and we're able to communicate better with their own language. And people trying to teach it just did not realize what was going on. ECQIS.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Bravo Zulu, you had a question and we tried to reach you and couldn't, but now that you're here, what did you want to say?
Just did a quick antenna repair. I hope you guys could read me. On an old Kenwood TH-75, if you remember that. Eric, if you can hear me, I found some photographs from WLIW in 1971, and I'd love to share them with you. I guess I'll just call you at the station maybe tomorrow, and you'll give me your email address. The other thing I wanted to say, in all seriousness, is, let me drop this. If I saw colors flow out of a television set onto a carpeting and then up a wall, why doesn't that, and I only did it twice or three times or whatever, but why doesn't that negate every rule and law of physics?
In a word, because it wasn't real. It was a perception going on at the level of your neurons firing. It was, if you will, a simulation of real world. You're running a simulation inside your brain. When your brain decides to do something, your conscious mind isn't even aware of it for a few hundred milliseconds. There's that propagation delay from your unconscious control center to your conscious. So simply because your internal simulation tells you something doesn't mean it's true. That's the whole point of delusion.
But then, you know, who's to say which side of the equation is true?
Hopefully the outside observer. You know, you kind of, unfortunately, it's a Democratic vote. If you see colors bleeding off the side of the wall, and there's 10 people, and the other 9 people don't, or they see other things that are weird, then that's not reality. And especially if it goes against your concept of what reality is, I would hope that somewhere in my head I would be able to recognize that that doesn't make any sense and there's something wrong with my perception. But, you know, you're free to have your own perceptions. If you want to think that a hallucinogenic drug causes the laws of physics to change, so be it.
I always wondered if Einstein had an LSD experience, if he would have thought different about the universe. Maybe not, but I don't know, maybe you've had to have experienced it, you know, which is the real one. But I understand what you're saying. Eric, what's the best way to get a hold of you tomorrow? Rich is Rich, W2BZ.
I guess Eric is busy, so if he comes back and breaks in, he'll tell you how to get in touch with him. Some kind gentleman in the chat room mentioned that this is the Sunday evening BioNet. I think of it as the ScienceNet, and if it makes them feel any better, next week I'll bring up a subject about special and general relativity, which will have absolutely nothing to do with biology whatsoever, I hope. So does anyone have any other comments, questions, statements about this general subject before I tie it up into a little bow? Because I do want to get to the space net. Paul has been very kind to wait for us.
Well, you mentioned in the email that you want to discuss Feynman.
Okay, well, I sort of mentioned that we may get to it, but, you know, this one topic took up an hour and a half, and I don't want Paul to end up giving a space report from 11:55 to 12 midnight. So we'll do that some other week. I have an endless stream of little bits and pieces of stuff that I can pull out. I can bend people's ear in an unbelievable amount of time. But, you know, there's only so much time each Sunday night. So Once again, if we could kind of find our way back to the subject, and then I'll tie it up, and then Paul will do his SpaceNet report, I would hope.
So if I understand correctly, this was a deeper discussion of why is the sky blue?
Not exactly. It was more to do, in my mind at least, with the interesting difference between a color as a particular frequency in the electromagnetic spectrum, which is sort of what a physicist would think about, versus a color that human beings perceive and very much think of as existing just as much as a color frequency is. And some people conflate the two. That's my idea of what this bigger discussion was meant to be.
The modern-day very high-efficiency light-emitting diodes that we buy, you can now buy them and you perceive them as almost a pure white. Well, the light that you get from, say, sunlight is really a complete spectrum where all the frequencies in between are filled in, so to speak. And you can't easily do that with light-emitting diodes. All they need to do is have a certain percentage of red phosphor, green phosphor, and blue phosphor inside of that light-emitting diode. The human visual system will say, aha, that's white, even though there's only three discrete frequencies there. And so you perceive it as white, but at times it can give you some weird response because it really isn't white. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
AC2GS. Well, yes, engineers are using tricks that our biology evolved with to get one over us. It is incredibly much more difficult, you as an engineer would know, of having to replicate an almost infinite number of different colors in the spectrum. It's very lucky that our brain came up with this tricolor way to encode every color in the spectrum. So engineers utilize that in many ways, and one of them is the red, green, blue LEDs. Now, the sun, again, if you want to be, I always like being nitpicky and the devil's advocate, if you really take a good prism, a good spectrograph, you will find little black lines running across the emissions from the sun. So it's not a perfect spectrum. There are some absorption lines from the gases that are blocking those frequencies on the sun. And that's how we're able to tell what stars are made of, because of those absorption spectroscopy lines.
You know, when you watch TV, you have three different boxes that you're actually looking at. And they have the particular spectrum they developed something called a CIE curve, which actually spells out what the eyeball needs to see. And there's been a number of physiological psychology, doctorate programs that go into that. And I can tell you a couple of interesting stories about the concept of visual perception. And same thing goes for audio. We have compression schemes that utilize what the brain does.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of psychoacoustics. It's very important if you're going to design a really good compression algorithm to know exactly what are the cues that human beings are getting from a signal and getting rid of everything else that it's contained. If you don't have a good model for human beings' means of compressing it internally, you're not going to have a good idea of how to compress it externally.
Eric, are there some high-end television sets that have red, green, blue, and yellow emitters in that display?
Yes, they are. Sharp holds the patent on that, and you'll see their advertising shows four dots instead of three. And by the way, when you listen to something called Dolby AC3, if you were listening to Beethoven's Fifth, at the height of the crescendo, there's a little triangle that goes in the back, and the algorithm says, you ain't going to hear it, so I ain't going to record it.
Wow. These high-end sets that have a patent for the yellow What do they claim the yellow is buying? Does it give a more true color of, say, flesh tone, so to speak?
Now, if you go back to the days of your analog TV, when you had I and Q, you had a subcarrier that had your chroma information, which was another angular modulation scheme. You'll find that there's a matrix involved in terms of how much red, how much green, and how much blue. Blue is 11% of the picture. Green is 58%, and the rest is red. That bandwidth reduction also it deals with the sensitivity of your eyes in terms of color.
Yeah, I think the eye can perceive red very nicely, but the rate at which the red can change and the brain doesn't see it is such that in order to save bandwidth, I think they made the red bandwidth on the tricolor sets up a smaller bandwidth because the human eye can't see the red change very fast. Isn't that true, Eric?
That's correct. That's why the green is derived from the luminance, which has the full bandwidth. The red is 0.5 of a megahertz, and the blue is 0.2 of a megahertz in terms of bandwidth. So that's how it fits nicely up there at the top before the sound carrier.
If the green has the full bandwidth, does that mean something like 4.5 megahertz, Eric? Go ahead.
That's correct. I'm trying to think of who did this, but you know, you can stare at a black and white picture for a long period of time and then close your eyes and you actually see color in the picture. That's one of the physiological things that that system takes advantage of. I don't know if I can explain exactly how that plays a role in it, but it does.
It's color fatigue. It's a well-known aspect of cones and such.
There you go. The concept of putting the yellow in there, now don't forget, you get the three primary colors, red, green, and blue. Yellow is a secondary. It's a mixture of green and cyan. Rather, magenta and cyan, sorry.
But magenta isn't a true color either.
Well, you got your three primaries and three secondaries. Actually, film uses secondaries as their dyes, as opposed to a light source where we use the primaries.
Primary is additive, secondary is subtractive.
That's correct. So if you're looking at a photograph, what's happening is the photograph is absorbing they're absorbing the complement colors of the color that's being reflected.
Free entirely.
So the primaries are red, green, and blue. The secondaries are yellow, magenta, and cyan.
And everyone that has to pay inkjet printer and the laser printers know those colors very, very well and pay dearly for them.
You know, when we work in television, we're working with light sources as opposed to a full-spectrum light having the pieces absorbed and only reflected the individual colors.
I understand.
So anyway, today's television is different. Dick, if you remember, when you did a purity on your TV set, that nearly really didn't quite look red. It looked a little orangey, didn't it?
There were some sets where the red really did look red, Joy. Here we go, Eric.
Yeah, but not a deep saturated red. It's all about contrast in your eyeballs in terms of one source of light versus another. You know, we're starting to talk about sets now with high dynamic range. Instead of the typical 8 bits that you would use for colors, now we're doing 24 bits, 32 bits. So we've got more numbers of colors that we could actually produce, so on and so forth. The actual size of the dots, if you're using an LED-based display, OLED, they now have something called MLED. Now I can't remember what it's another quantum LED type thing where you actually each pixel is an LED, and it makes it an unbelievably dynamic picture. It's getting to the point where your eyes can't resolve the differences.
In the old days, we've actually gone past it. The palettes that are now available, unless you're some kind of superhuman colorist, it defies people's ability to tell the difference, you know, one significant bit different.
WS2N. Yeah, Eric, were you thinking of AMOLED, active matrix?
Yeah, no, it's something that came out about 2 or 3 months ago. I can't remember what it's called, but it's MLED. I'm going to look it up.
In the old days of cathode ray tubes, I think they had great trouble finding a phosphor that gave them a pure red, and the phosphors they were using, I think, were very low in efficiency. So I think the red portion of the old cathode ray tubes represented an awful lot of grief. Isn't that true, Eric?
Yeah, well, you know, chemistry has come light years away. I mean, you know, you're dealing with basically a strontium compound that makes that red output. So it's gotten better, but you still, it's like rocks, okay? When you look at a CRT, it looks kind of grayish when there's no light coming out of it. When there's light and your eye has something to deal with contrast, that's when you see black. Otherwise, you would just see gray.
So you think you're seeing black, but you're really seeing gray, but it's so much darker than the illumination when the CRT is working that by contrast, comparison, it is black. I think the total dynamic range of how bright to how dark of each of the colors in a cathode ray tube was a lot higher than we're able to get with many of the solid-state compact screens today. Is that still true, Eric? Go ahead.
Say again, Eric.
The total white-to-black dynamic range, white-to-black ratio of a cathode ray tube, I think for a long time was higher than you could get with the more modern flat-screen displays. I presume that's slowly getting better. Is that true?
Oh, we've surpassed that. Most of your 4K displays are capable of producing more than what your eyeball can see, and they beat the pants off the CRT in terms of contrast ratio. The ability to... It used to be we'd have the ability to, if we wanted to do it by numbers, you could actually split it up to 256 different levels, and that was your typical CRT display. Now you're talking about 1024 or 2048, the ability of having individual light levels of a particular pixel or a particular color.
And you're saying the digital format of the frames being transmitted from the broadcast transmitter is carrying that much information? There's really 2,000 or 4,000 potential levels of red, green, and blue?
That's correct. With a little bit of fudging going on, because don't forget, we're doing this in a compression scheme. The stuff that's coming across really is nothing more than a series of coefficients after doing a bunch of discrete cosine transforms.
So there's a kind of compression on transmission and a decompression on reception going on?
Right, well, you have to separate the two. You being an analog guy, tend not to do that. The transmission compression is all about reproducing the same number that you're transmitting, okay? And in essence, we really don't compress the data that's coming out of the transmitter. The transmitter doesn't do any kind of compression. It actually wraps it in, for the sake of simplicity, it wraps it with an error correction code or a CRC code or whatever kind of forward error correction you might want to think of. there's stuff that we do to try and overcome the errors of transmission. Errors of transmission, not reducing bandwidth. The reduction of bandwidth is done in the creation of the stream that you're transmitting. The stream, or the MPEG stream, and actually with the 4K stuff, you're using H.267, which is a next level of MPEG compression that actually shakes and throws away bits and just makes the representation of a block of pixel. It looks at it in the frequency domain and just takes the average of those and sends those numbers to be sent to the receiver to be put back together as the original source by doing an inverse discrete cosine transform.
So if you know that the displays of ice that typically is being used by a television watcher has a certain degree of gamma compression or a certain kind of nonlinearity of the video circuitry, you can anticipate this and transmit the data with the inverse curve of the distortion so that the resultant display is almost distortionless. Is that almost what's happening, Eric?
Kinda. There's different aspects of what your eyeball actually detects. There's a number of things that are going on in terms of reducing bandwidth. And a lot of that is not only the difference in levels of light, but also in spatial reduction and the reduction of, or the faking of motion.
So is there dithering or anti-dithering that tries to get rid of the jogging or whatever it's called, the artifacts that would appear on the screen? Go ahead.
Well, if you have a true display that displays both 1080i and 1080p, with the 1080i, you're going to see the artifacts you're talking about. With the 1080p, you're not going to see them because it's twice the frame rate, and it's line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, as opposed to lines 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, and then lines 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on and so forth.
What percentage of the broadcast over the air is sent progressive as opposed to interlaced?
Depends upon what channel you're looking at and what their engineers decided they were going to do. It also depends upon how many streams they want to put into their 6 megahertz. Typically, when Fox went HD, actually live, they didn't go HD first. They went 525p, and then eventually they moved up to 720p. You can put two really nice 720p's in 6 megahertz and still have a little room to spare. You can put one 1080i in 6 megahertz, and if you want to do full bandwidth like CBS did, where they ran it at 18 megabits in the beginning, it's the best picture on the planet. Of course, the cable companies and the satellite companies de-res it for you because they got more channels they need to step into their space. But if you watch it over the air and then compare it to cable or satellite, you'll say, this is like night and day.
If I understand you correctly, there is a general trend that over the air is higher in resolution than what you get through a typical cable. So I think you're saying, Eric, right?
That's what I'm saying. Although if you go to a channel like ION, which is 31-1234567-8910, they, in fact, reduce the bit rates so they can stuff all those signals in there. The compression algorithms have gotten a lot better over the years, whereas you can now use less bandwidth to produce about the same kind of picture. So that gives them the ability to put multiple streams. But you'll find that a lot of the stations which have these multiple streams are really doing 525p, compressed widescreen, so it looks like it's HD, but it's not. You'll find lots of different tricks happening. But if you're looking at the purists like CBS, even though they have one sub-channel, that sub-channel runs at about a half a megabit. So that's...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Timeout.
Comment.
comment. Who was that with very low audio? Roy, maybe it's time we go over to the space report. Although I do have one quick question about GPS that was in your recent email. Maybe you could squeeze it in. What do you think, Roy?
AC2GS. Well, I'm always game if you are. It's just I think that would expand to another hour discourse on relativity. And I thought maybe we'd do that next week unless something amazing happened in the ensuing week. But can I at least tie up my question with an answer and put a little bow on top of it?
You've got it, Roy.
Okie doke. So I get to Indigo as a little bit of a tricky question because if any of you had physics in high school, you learned the mnemonic Roy G. Biv for the spectrum, which I particularly liked because it was my first name and I never hear my first name. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Those are the colors of the spectrum that we're taught. Indigo is a very special one because human perception is very waffly with indigo. It's a true color, but it's a true color that most humans can't perceive. So that's where the perception is kind of one thing and the true frequency is another. Surprisingly, magenta and purple aren't true colors. They're combinations of red and blue. Violet is a true color. Indigo is a true color that can't be perceived. Brown is not a true color. It's yellow with a low illumination. Pink is red with a high general illumination of the other two receptors. And those are composite colors that are not defined by a single frequency. So the answer to my question going back of what was a true color based on a single frequency, the answer was only of those indigo, which we can't perceive as a different color than violet. So that's my little trick question for the night here.
Is it possible to transmit violet as a single color, Roy?
Yes, violet is a certain frequency, but violet is not the same, unfortunately, as purple. Purple, by whatever definition color people put on colors, is a composite of red and blue, not the same as violet. Third, eh?
And there are insects that see very far into the ultraviolet, aren't there?
Yes, as I mentioned before, reptiles and insects are tetrachromic. They possess a fourth receptor in the ultraviolet range, which is why sometimes you'll see ultraviolet photography of butterflies, and they have these incredibly complex patterns that can only be visualized in the ultraviolet range. And, you know, humans being humans say, what the good is that? But they're not doing it for us. They're doing it for other butterflies that they want to mate with. Now, you know, we can someday go into all kinds of interesting color theory because I have something in my shack, a beautiful blue morpho butterfly. It's a beautiful shade of blue and doesn't have any blue dye any place on its body. So that's one of the many things that we could discourse about color down the road sometime.
ACQIS coming.
Yes, Bill.
Nick was asking if purple was different from violet, and yes, they are very different. Purple is a combination of red and blue that you do not get at a single frequency because you're exciting the red color receptor and the blue color receptor more than you could with a single frequency color. Right? If you've got violet, you've got a weird color. It's not a bell curve, really. got for the red receptor, it's got a peak, you know, centered on some red frequency. But there's an additional peak way high beyond where the blue receptor is. So when you get a violet, that's off to the right of our blue receptor and into the secondary peak of our red receptor. That's a single frequency color. It shows up as having a little bit of red on our red receptors, whereas purple is something that we get by combining essentially red light and blue light. And if we wanted to go further into this, we could get into color spaces. There's a huge conversation about that. Differences between additive colors and subtractive colors and how we end up perceiving those colors, really, as far as we're concerned, about human perception, I think, more so than frequency. So it's kind of an odd thing to me to hear that certain things are colors and certain things are not colors. To me, anything that we perceive is color, if not a single frequency emission of radiation, ET2IS.
Comment, what's the two problems with?
Yes, comment away.
Well, first, I have a question. What do you guys think has been the biggest consumer electronics failure of the last quarter century?
That's a little off subject, and if Dick wants to go through it, that's great, but I just want to continue tying this up in a bow, and Bill mentioned some things, and I'd like to address them. It's a matter of semantics. They're all colors. There's a difference in semantics about, say, true colors based on a single frequency versus perceived colors based upon a more complex additive function of different frequencies. And as far as the violet reception is a kind of rollover to the red, all things are relative, so there's two completely different ways of looking at the same exact thing. What's happening is your visual cortex is measuring the green reception and red reception. So if the red reception is higher or if the green is lower because the color is in the purple range instead of blue. If it had been blue, the green receptor would have some bleed through because of the curve. So it's seeing a kind of zero or negative level, if you will, with the green, and it's taking a relative reading between the red and the green. So you can fake the receptor of the low green by pouring in a little bit of red to confound and trick your system even more. But theoretically, the reason you see violet is because it's picking up the blue receptor output with absolutely no green receptor output, and that's what the coding is going on. But there are other tricks that can be used for purple and magenta and everything else.
Actually off topic, the answer is 3D television, and I was wondering if you guys, scientists-type guys, engineers, thought maybe it was because of what we're talking about right now with the color spectrum and mixing it and the human eye not enjoying the result.
Eric, you've attended a whole lot of consumer electronic shows, and I think there's been a lot of claims that three-dimensional displays were going to become popular, and they never really did. It's an extremely difficult problem. I think you have, at one time or another, owned a three-dimensional display. Is that KE2EJ, K2RIW?
RIW, KE2J. There's a couple kinds of 3D displays. In the early days, you had a pair of glasses with a battery in it. And if you look at the center of it, there's actually a little photoreceptor there that's a phototransistor. And the set itself sends out a little infrared pulse, which says, I'm transmitting the left eye view, now I'm transmitting the right eye view. And the electrophotochromic glasses actually goes into full attenuation on the left eye when the right eye is being displayed, and it does the same thing on the right eye when the left eye is being displayed. That's one method. Let me let it drop. The newer sets, and by the way, you buy a high-end set, a 4K display, they're all 3D. Now they do the same thing that you get in the movies. You go to the movie theater, you've got one, actually, eye view, which is left-hand circularly polarized, and you have another eye view, which is right-hand circularly polarized, and the polarization is done on the screens of the newer sets. You don't need an active set of glasses to see it. And because we're talking about glasses that have a certain density to it, and it also has a certain achromic response that actually modifies the color slightly.
Ultimately, it's because most directors don't do it well. If it wasn't made by James Cameron, the 3D effect tends to not look very attractive, in my humble opinion.
Let me tell you why. There are visual processes, which actually I've worked with a few of them, which stimulate the 3D view, whereas most of the stuff is shot flat, you know, 2D, and they do this processing on it, and you have control over depth by changing the ratio between the two cameras, or the simulation of two cameras. There's a lot of tricks that you can pull, and really it's not so much the director as it is the editor and the people who are doing the visual processing, which is a whole other group of people. Although, if you're talking about Cameron, he actually shot the stuff in 3D, and with the visual processors, he modified his shots to make things more dramatic, let's say.
The problem is that the tricks aren't effective for most people. They don't enjoy the experience.
Here's another experience with WCDC that I had a few months ago in L.A. Am I doubling with anybody? Okay. A friend of mine, pretty well-known and wealthy producer, had an 88-inch screen on his wall in his living room. And he and his wife were tired, so they went up to bed. And I couldn't wait to get that clicker in my hand. And I had the biggest shock of my life. 90% of it was unwatchable. Because if you're not shooting at the, you know, at the resolutions or quality of the display, it looks horrible. At 88 inches, are you kidding me? There was very few things I could watch.
If you move back about 20 feet from that screen, you might have been comfortable.
Yeah, you could have moved next door.
No, the surprising thing is film, not tape, but film that I watched looked like tape. And, you know, Eric knows this, you know, we had a nice talk about back in the day, we always try to make tape look like film. But, you know, motion pictures that I was watching with this thing looked like tape. That type of clear look, whatever you want to call it.
Talk about it's a live look. I can explain that. Sort of like looking through, that's like looking at video. When they do the film transfer, film normally has a gamma of like 0.2, 0.3. It's got this nice, smooth, logarithmic curve down on the bottom, which gives it that film look. That's where the contrast ratios are. And the thing that film always had over television in the early days is that the knee in the film is kind of noise-free, where you could show subtle differences. Like if it was a really dark scene, you had a street lamp, and things would really look like you were there, but with that film kind of look. A lot of films that are transferred today, because they're on these digital scanners, what they do is they actually set it to 0.8 or 1, which is sort of a straight line, and that kind of gives it that live video look, or like looking through a window rather than a film. That's purely subjective. That's how you perceive what it is that you're looking at. For some people, that live look is the best thing in the world compared to film, and for real film buffs, they hate it. So, you know, you're talking about something that's more psychological than anything else.
As you know, Eric, back in the day, the whole thing was to make tape look like film. And it's, to me, it's like, you know, I've been a cameraman and done a lot of editors, done a lot of things in the TV business, the film business, and it's like a cosmic joke that now, you know, with the technology, film looks fat like tape. It's like, what was all that for? Anyway, Eric, I found a bunch of pictures from 1971 I took as an employee of WLIW. I'd love to email them to you. My telephone number is 644-4809. Just give me a call, leave a message, and I'll email them to you.
Funny you should ask that. Yeah, actually, I'm going to call you because they're trying to put together a 50th anniversary for the station. And, of course, when the new people came in, they decided to throw everything away. So the vice president of the station is asking anyone and everyone if they've got any stuff at home to bring it in and send it in. So that sounds like something like a real use.
I have some pictures, good ones, of the black and white, all black and white, of the control room, which you'll get a kick out of. And it's 631-644-4809. All right, guys, thanks.
What's your call?
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Good. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Remember we had that conversation about Sam Adwar and all those guys? Anyway, speak to you. I don't want to hold up the net. Guys, thanks for putting up with this old Kenwood T-875.
Maybe someday down the road we can discuss frame rate increases that make people annoyed and think that they're watching videotapes as well.
I don't know if you've ever gone to IMAX, but IMAX is running at 30 frames.
I'm fine with 30 frames, but guys like Cameron want to do, 48 frames per second and even greater. They're really into this high-tech stuff, even though it looks awful to our eyes, because we're not used to it, unfortunately.
So, you know, the Super IMAX that they shot on the space station, that was done at 60 frames. Actually, most people don't realize, when they go to the movie theater, their eyeballs are seeing 48 frames, even though the film is 24.
Okay, but they're just showing the same frame twice, right?
Correct. And in the days of old television, where you actually had to divide 24 into 30, and the way they did that is first two frames would be played twice, the next frame would be one field, and then the successive frame would be the other field. So it was a 3-2 ratio.
Once again, the engineer's life is to game the system using the biological tricks we were evolved with, and they worked very well.
In the early days, 2-inch tape, quad tape, was actually cut with the scissors and taped together between the sink horns.
You use a razor blade and some magic iron filings that you would put on the tape to develop it.
It's just incredibly slow and whatever. By the way, just something to think about, a subject for down the road or not, that's fine. I've been getting into a field, researching a field called pen testing. Pen testing, which is short for penetration testing, which gets into communication, you know, at the packet and frame level, that is absolutely fascinating. And it's what the world is running on right now. And it's just, there's a free program called Wireshark. We could take a look, you know, could drill down all the way down. And it's just amazing stuff.
We use it all the time.
You should bring that up in the computer net.
On the job?
Give you a quick example, and by the way, you guys were doubling. Right now, we're running, I just finished building the studio here, and it's going to be run from New York. We're having real network issues, and Wireshark is your saving grace. You can actually see everything that's being put over that network, and you can actually get down to the individual packets that have information in them. And right now we're in the process of trying to find some things that aren't working out too well, and Wireshark is a way that you can visualize what's going on in your network.
I know. Do you know that they could even put together reassembled packets that could give you voice over IP audio?
We do that for video. Actually, there are other devices that are more tailored to that. Wireshark is more a general troubleshooting tool if you want to look at it from that perspective.
As I'm playing with this thing drilling down, you know, to the frame level, it's very unsettling because you could hide stuff, bad stuff. The bad guys can hide stuff in you know, one bit of a frame of a packet. And I don't know. I just think that it's unstoppable, the bad side of it.
Yeah, we ought to let Roy. Roy, did you get a chance to really tie off so that now we should be going over to the space report, AC2GS, K2LAW?
AC2GS. Yes, I think I tied it up in a bow. The bottom line was that the only color that I gave you guys that was the true color was indigo. All the rest are composite colors made up of other primary fundamental colors with specific frequencies that you have to mix a bunch of different frequencies together to get them. So that was the bottom line. That was the bow on the top of it. So I'm done with that question, and hopefully next week we'll do something about special and general relativity that'll be far away from biology.
And we'll be comparing special to general. Not everyone knows the difference between the two. Okay. Time we go to space report number, 284. Whiskey 2. WS 2S. Whiskey Sierra 2, November. K2IW. Go ahead, good old. He knows who he is. Go ahead.
Very good, Dick. WS 2N. And the name's Paul. And you're right, we're up to 284. And a lot of things happening with the space program, but some of the things we're not going to get information on because of the federal government shutdown. You know, if this continues, as of tomorrow, from what I read, NASA will not be giving your standard information on their website. If it's anything like 2013, they shut down for 17 days at that time, and for 17 days you didn't have anything coming across on NASA's website, which is was a pain in the neck. But now I have a lot more websites to go to, more commercial websites, which bring up, you know, ongoing information, so I'm able to keep up with it, such as the spacewalk that will be coming up Tuesday. You have a EVA by Scott Tingle, and he's going to be with Mark Vanderheil. They'll be doing a spacewalk, and then the following week they'll be doing another spacewalk. Well, it'll be Mark Vanderheil and a fellow from the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA, J-A-X-A. That's Japan's version of NASA. So they'll be going out. They have to change out the, they call it the lead, the latching end effector. There's two of them attached to the Canadian robot arm. That thing is 57-foot long arm, and it has a connection that always attaches to the space station at some point. And then the other arm will do the work. We'll either grab a hold of a commercial cargo vehicle coming in, or a new module to be installed on the space station, or even an astronaut.